KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. Happy Mother's Day to all the moms and mother figures out there. Communication problems stall travel at one of the nation's busiest airports, and concerns are mounting about the state of U.S. aviation.
We lag dozens and dozens of other nations in terms of the number of controllers and in terms of the infrastructure and the technology.
Plus, researchers have confirmed that two shipwrecks off the coast of Costa Rica, once thought to be pirate ships, were actually slave ships from Denmark. It's Sunday, May 11th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. U.S. and Iranian officials are meeting again today, aimed at keeping Iran from developing nuclear weapons. The talks in the Gulf state of Oman come ahead of President Trump's visit to the region this week. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
This is the fourth round of talks between Iran and the U.S. since mid-April. An earlier one set for last weekend was postponed at the last minute for what Oman said was technical reasons. President Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, is due to meet with Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi to discuss Iran's nuclear program, sanctions relief, and uranium enrichment. Iran insists it has the right to enrich uranium for civilian use. President Trump has indicated he's willing to give negotiations with Iran a chance, but has not ruled out military strikes if the nuclear talks fail. The president is due to visit Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and United Arab Emirates this week. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
Representatives from the U.S. and China are meeting in Geneva, Switzerland for a second day. They're attempting to defuse trade tensions between the world's two largest economies. A ceasefire between India and Pakistan appears to be holding hours after both countries blamed each other for violating the agreement. President Trump had said earlier that the U.S. helped mediate the ceasefire. He's now offering to negotiate the territorial dispute over the Himalayan region of Kashmir. Amkar Kankar reports.
In a post on Truth Social, Trump said that he is, quote, going to increase trade substantially with both of these great nations. Additionally, he said he will work with both countries to see if a solution can be arrived at concerning Kashmir. The latest escalations between the countries started in Kashmir after India accused Pakistani gunmen of killing 26 civilians in late April. Pakistan denies this. The ceasefire on Saturday came after days of military action between the countries that killed more than 70 people. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, New Delhi.
The Tufts University doctoral student who was held for more than 6 weeks at a Louisiana immigration detention center is back in Boston. A federal judge ordered Rumaysa Oscar to release on Friday. Sarah Betancourt reports from Boston.
Oscar spoke for a little over 2 minutes at a press conference in Logan Airport. She smiled and blinked away tears while thanking her attorneys, who were also present. Oesterk was never formally charged with a crime, but the government implied a pro-Gaza opinion piece in a student newspaper co-written by Oesterk was the reason her visa was revoked. Her immigration court case will continue. Her next federal court hearing will focus on potential constitutional violations of her detention. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Betancourt in Boston.
This is NPR News in Washington. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says the Trump administration has repeatedly broken the law while deporting American citizens without due process. He says Congress has a constitutional responsibility to serve as a check on what he called the out-of-control policies of the executive branch. Despite growing economic uncertainty, Americans are still planning to spend big this Mother's Day, more than they did last year. NPR's Amy Held reports.
Some 84% of adults celebrate Mother's Day, spending a projected $34 billion. Per person, that's about $260 on average for the day, up $5 from last year, according to a survey by the National Retail Federation. The top gift, about 3/4 of them, are flowers, followed closely by cards. About 2/3 who spend plan an outing, like at a restaurant. But it's not just about spending money.
The key is spending time together.
Catherine Cullen is with the National Retail Federation and says gifting an experience is also getting popular.
Ways that they can create a meaningful memory with mom.
Mom can be a loose term. About 1/3 of people are celebrating other mothers. Amy Held, NPR News.
It's a tradition at the Musk Ox Farm in Palmer, Alaska since 1986. Mothers get free admission on Mother's Day, a flower, and a chance to view more than 70 members of the Musk Ox herd, a hoofed animal native to the Arctic. The farm's executive director says who doesn't want to celebrate Mother's Day with the Musk Ox mom and the most adorable calf you're ever going to find in your life. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. It's one of the nation's busiest airports, but two communication outages at Newark Liberty International Airport in just 2 weeks are raising serious concerns about passenger safety. The incidents have created chaos at the airport, leading to the delay or cancellation of hundreds of flights. Last week, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy called for a brand new air traffic control system to address the problem.
This is bold. This is going to be challenging, but we absolutely can do it.
Joining us now to talk about some of the challenges ahead is William McGee. He's a senior fellow for aviation and travel at the American Economic Liberties Project. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So can you give us a sense of just how serious the issues are at Newark?
Well, this year marks my 40th year working in the airlines and writing about the airlines and advocating for airline passengers. And this is about as serious an issue as I've ever seen in terms of air traffic control and safety.
And what exactly is going on that makes you so concerned?
Well, it's a confluence of events, and it's been going on for many, many years. Every time I hear someone in Washington say they're surprised by what's been happening, I have to shake my head, to be very honest with you, because if we're looking to assign blame, then we can go back to the Reagan administration and every administration since and every Congress since. The fact is that in the United States, we have the most complex and largest air traffic control network in the world, and we lag dozens and dozens of other nations in terms of the number of controllers and in terms of the infrastructure and the technology.
So what are the challenges facing the sector? I mean, talk to me about that.
Sure. Based on who you talk to, we're either short 3,000 air traffic controllers in the United States currently or 3,500. Either way, it's an unacceptable number. Previous administration last year hired 2,000 new controllers. It still wasn't enough. They made an effort, but it didn't put us where we need to be. You know, right now, Newark Liberty International Airport is sort of the poster child for everything that's wrong with air traffic control. But we're really sort of playing whack-a-mole because, you know, we've had problems at other airports and other air traffic control centers all across the country in the New York area and Florida. You may recall that in recent summers, the FAA directed airlines to reduce their schedules and reduce the number of flights because there simply weren't enough controllers to handle it.
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, he unveiled this sweeping plan to update old infrastructure. Do you think that plan goes far enough?
Well, I can't comment simply because he didn't give enough details. I watched every minute. I live streamed it and I tweeted about it. It went on for about 2 hours. You know, the devil is going to be in the details. President Trump joined Duffy by phone at one point, and he said something that really set off alarm bells for me. He said, we're going to give, in his words, President Trump, a big, beautiful contract to one company. Well, this is complex work. It involves hundreds and hundreds of facilities all across the country, airports all across the country, and there isn't one company that you sign a contract with, even if it is Elon Musk and Starlink, which many of us are worried about, that can fix this overnight. They're talking about an initial investment of $12.5 billion. That won't be even nearly enough.
You've covered this industry for decades, first as a journalist, but you also worked as an aircraft dispatcher. Given everything that you've seen and heard, how worried are you about the future of flight safety in this country?
You know, it's an excellent question because I'm usually someone that I think is a bit of a calming influence. And I usually say, look, you know, statistically, this is still by far the safest form of transportation and we need to put things in perspective. But I will tell you that I myself am a little worried right now because I just don't see the seriousness and the sense of purpose from this administration. We are getting such mixed messages from the president, from the Secretary of Transportation, and then from Elon Musk, who is going in and, you know, he's the one that used as a metaphor a chainsaw. The FAA is not where we need to use a chainsaw, not by any means. There shouldn't be any cutting at the FAA unless it's proven to be, you know, waste of some kind. But this is an agency that has been understaffed and underfunded for four decades.
That's aviation expert William McGee. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
President Trump has a new pick for U.S. Surgeon General. He's tapped wellness influencer Dr. Casey Means. That's in place of his original choice, former Fox News contributor Dr. Jeanette Neshwat. NPR's Will Stone is here with the details. Hi, Will.
Hey there.
Why did Trump drop his first pick for Surgeon General?
So no official statement from Trump or the White House on that, but it seems there may have been a few issues at play here. So first, Neshwat had come under scrutiny recently for misrepresenting her medical credentials, including where she went to medical school. This was revealed by an independent reporter, Anthony Clark, and has been matched by other outlets, though NPR has not independently confirmed the reporting. At the same time, Neshwat was also facing some strong opposition from those on the right and in Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Jr.'s Make America Healthy Again or MAHA movement. One reason was her support for COVID policies like masking and vaccines. So whatever the rationale, Trump took to social media this week and announced he tapped Dr. Casey Means instead, saying she has, quote, impeccable MAHA credentials.
Well, tell us more about Casey Means. Who is she?
Yeah, she's a wellness influencer, author, and entrepreneur. She has a company that sells glucose monitoring devices to consumers. Her background is in medicine. She went to Stanford Medical School and went on to surgical residency, but she dropped out pretty far along in the program. Her book is kind of a self-help diet type of book. It really catapulted her into the online wellness space. She's been on big podcasts. She appeared at a highly publicized congressional roundtable on nutrition last year that featured Secretary Kennedy and other big names in the MAHA world. But her resume is definitely a problem for many in medicine and public health. She did have a practice in Oregon, but again, never completed her residency, and she doesn't have an active medical license right now. I called up Dr. Richard Carmona to get his take on this. Carmona was the Surgeon General under George W. Bush.
Every previous Surgeon General, when you look, they've got the license, they've got the residency, they have had at least some leadership ability that's scalable, and we don't see any of that here. I think that our nation deserves better.
How are her supporters responding to this?
Well, Secretary Kennedy is doubling down on his support. He's claiming Dr. Means will be the greatest Surgeon General in American history. It's also worth noting her brother, Callie Means, is a prominent advisor to Kennedy. A lot of her messaging aligns with the secretary. She rails against the healthcare industry, big food and big pharma, talks a lot about nutrition and lifestyle. Here's what Kennedy said on Fox News just the other day.
Casey Means, we felt, was the best person to really bring the vision of MAHA to the American public. She has this unique capacity to articulate it.
Now, Casey Means has made statements casting doubt on the safety of certain vaccines and the vaccine schedule. She's also endorsed things like raw milk, similar to Kennedy. All of this is concerning to experts in public health. But some in the Kennedy coalition are not happy with the pick. For example, Kennedy's former running mate, Nicole Shanahan, has criticized the choice heavily, as have others. And some of the pushback has to do with her vaccine stance, that she has not come out strongly enough against vaccines, especially the COVID shots. So this choice is revealing, I'd say, some fractures in the MAHA coalition, and that plus concerns about her lack of experience could derail her nomination. We'll see.
That's NPR's Will Stone. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
The Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, has announced some new inductees to its World Video Game Hall of Fame. John Paul Dyson is the museum's vice president for exhibits. And no, he wasn't named after a pope.
I joke that the popes were named after me.
One of the newly enshrined games was released only a few years into John Paul II's papacy. It's the side-scrolling space shooter called Defender from 1981.
You are operating a spaceship in which you are both trying to repel the attacks of these alien invaders while saving these humans that are walking around and being kidnapped by the aliens. And that inherent complexity showed that the medium had reached a point where players were ready to tackle multiple things going on all at once and to operate so quickly.
In the 1990s, players loved Tamagotchi, little handheld digital pets living, if everything went well, on a little LCD screen.
The gameplay itself lends itself to complexity and this emotional element in caring for this electronic pet and trying to keep it alive.
You can never get over the loss of your first Tamagotchi. Also inducted into the World Video Game Hall of Fame, Quake, a 3D first-person shooter game.
You're fighting these monsters who are coming at you. But some of the significance of Quake is it's one of the first really online games that allow multiplayer matches. And so led to the development of what's known as esports today, for instance, where people are competing in video games against each other.
And the last inductee, another first-person shooter, GoldenEye, based on the James Bond movie.
It took the James Bond character and brought it into the video game universe in a way that a lot of video games haven't done as well. When we hooked it up in one of our labs here, all the players who grew up with this, it was like going back to their childhood.
Those four classic games now join Pac-Man, Super Mario, and others in the World Video Game Hall of Fame. Hope you enjoyed this digital trip down random access memory lane. You're listening to News, NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Ukrainian President Zelensky says it's a positive sign that Russian President Putin is proposing direct talks to end the war, but he said Putin must agree to a ceasefire first. Putin says the two sides should meet in Istanbul Thursday without preconditions. Pope Leo XIV called for an authentic and lasting peace in Ukraine in St. Peter's Square today as he delivered his first Sunday message as pontiff. and voters in Albania are casting ballots in a parliamentary election. Socialist Prime Minister Edi Rama is seeking a fourth term. He's promising that Albania will join the European Union by 2030. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, and supporting land conservation initiatives.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. President Trump is trying to end collective bargaining for most of the federal workforce. He claims that having to negotiate with labor unions over workplace issues is getting in the way of his agenda. In some ways, he has a point. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, unions do serve as a check on presidential power.
More than half of federal employees are represented by unions, but this wasn't always the case. President Kennedy first granted federal workers the right to organize and collectively bargain in the early 1960s. The government had been seeing rapid growth, as described in a film from the era.
More than 2 million workers in more different kinds of jobs than there are in any other business, conducting the biggest business in the United States, that of your federal government.
Nicholas Handler, a law professor from Texas A&M, says at the time the government was facing a recruiting crisis.
They need scientists, they need economists, they need lawyers.
The government couldn't pay big salaries, but it could offer something else, stability and job protection, the right to be represented by a union.
Collective bargaining becomes an attractive tool for presidents to recruit people into the federal civil service that otherwise might be difficult to recruit.
And in 1978, Congress made it the law, asserting that collective bargaining in the civil service was in the public interest. And Handler says there was something in it for Congress, too, by giving workers a say in how they're managed.
It creates a way in for Congress and the courts to kind of police executive branch mismanagement.
Take a scenario in which a president wants to weaken a particular agency, say the Environmental Protection Agency.
A backdoor way of undermining EPA enforcement is just to make life for a bureaucrat working at the EPA really, really miserable.
Collective bargaining gives those bureaucrats a way to push back, to preserve their ability to carry out their agency's missions as Congress intended. That was the idea anyway. Now Trump says these labor rights are dangerous, that they make federal workers unaccountable. In late March, he signed an executive order ending collective bargaining at a broad array of agencies he claims have national security as a primary function. He's extended that as far as the EPA, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Food and Drug Administration. His order faces multiple lawsuits. Already, unions have been sidelined.
Basically, we've been ignored.
Anthony Lee is president of NTEU Chapter 282, representing close to 9,000 employees at the FDA. He says the Trump administration has violated their collective bargaining agreement in numerous ways. Take recent mass layoffs. The contract says the union must get advance notice. But Lee only learned layoffs were underway when he started getting panicked calls.
My phone started buzzing at 6:30 in the morning.
Employees were finding out they were being fired while swiping their badges to get into work.
Green is go, red is stop, and it just went red, and they weren't able to enter the building.
Lee worries that if Trump gets his way, workers will lose the stability and protections that made working for the government worthwhile. He's especially concerned that scientists will lose protection from political pressure. Under the union contract, employees who review food ingredients or drugs have a right to flag safety or efficacy concerns without fear of retribution. Now, under Trump,
it remains to be seen as to whether or not they're going to allow employees to do the job that the public expects, protecting and promoting the health and safety of the public.
Now, one of Trump's repeated complaints is that unions make it too hard to get rid of poor performers. In fact, many union contracts do spell out lengthy processes for doing so. But Armando Rosario Lebron contends his union makes the government run more smoothly.
Our collective bargaining agreement is a huge efficiency boost for the government.
His union represents Department of Agriculture employees who keep invasive pests and plants out of the country. These people work a lot of overtime, and he says it's the union that manages that.
How do you divvy that up so that it's fair to all parties involved? That is probably our biggest savings to the government, and I know that a lot of managers love that.
As for poor performers, Rosario Lebron says there are plenty of times he's told someone, hey, what you did was wrong. We can't defend this. Accept the consequences.
They're more likely to listen to us.
Get rid of the union, he warns, and management will be on its own. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Energy Star, the government program that for decades has helped consumers choose energy-efficient appliances, is on the chopping block. The move is part of the Trump administration's efforts to downsize the Environmental Protection Agency. Steve Nadel is the executive director of the American Council for an Energy-Efficient Economy, a nonprofit research organization that advocates for policies to reduce energy waste and combat climate change. He joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to do this.
So let's go back to 1992. How did Energy Star begin?
It began under the George H.W. Bush administration. They were looking for things that would aid the market and help consumers to choose more efficient products, but to be voluntary so that it's ultimately up to each consumer whether they want to do a particular action or not, but to kind of lead the horses to water, if you will.
Okay. And so it kind of showed you what appliances were the most efficient. And to be clear, this is a recognition program. This wasn't a program that set energy efficiency standards, right?
Right. It recognizes the best products, but it's up to each consumer. Do they want to buy one of these products or not?
What have been Energy Star's results so far?
The results have been enormous. Evaluations show that since it began, the program has saved about $500 billion in energy bills. The products that they've recognized have improved in market share and efficiency. In many cases, they've had to revise and strengthen the specifications in order to keep recognizing the top performing products. So it's really helped move the market.
So the Trump administration wants to downsize government and cut what they say is waste, fraud, and abuse. So when it comes to Energy Star, how much does the program cost the government to maintain?
It costs about $30 million a year, but saves about $40 billion a year in consumer bills.
Some might say that it's already in the interest of manufacturers to make the best and most efficient products that consumers want to buy. So why is a government program necessary?
The government is a trusted, independent source of information. Consumers might question what a manufacturer says because, of course, they want to sell more products. So the government helps to recognize the more efficient products in a way that consumers can say, okay, yes, I want the more efficient product. Yes, I trust this. And they're more likely to buy the efficient products than if just the manufacturer said, this is efficient, please buy it.
Have there been a lot of complaints about Energy Star? I mean, I covered the environment and energy for a long time. Energy efficiency was one of those things that wasn't very controversial, especially if it wasn't mandatory.
No, it has. The program has widespread support. As I mentioned, it was started under the first President Bush. The second President Bush continued it and supported it, as did various Democratic presidents. Only recently that President Trump has decided to question it. I'd also note that a lot of the manufacturers, a lot of the building owners are strong supporters of the program. They find it very useful to help them to improve their products, improve their buildings, and get recognized for it. So, yeah, Trump is the exception to the widespread support.
That's Steve Nadel of the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Comic books in the 1950s were full of superheroes swishing about in their capes and masks. But another genre was gaining ground fast: horror. These comics featured vampires, werewolves, axe murderers, and gory depictions of violence. They triggered a full-blown moral panic. In response, the Comics Code Authority, a self-regulating industry body, was forced to act.
They actually outlawed the word horror, and they forbade the use of vampires, werewolves. It was really a strong effort to kind of make comics kind of antiseptic.
That's Michael Dean, editor of a new collection of long-forgotten Marvel horror comics called Lost Marvel's Number One, Tower of Shadows. They were first published in 1969, by which time social attitudes had begun to shift. I started our conversation by asking Dean how the horror ban played out more than a decade earlier.
There was a big backlash against comics. Parents boycotted them. There was a book called Seduction of the Innocent by Frederick Wortham, which focused on comics as a cause of juvenile delinquency. And there was a Senate subcommittee hearing, and one of their primary targets was a line of comics called EC Comics. Those are known today as some of the best artists and writers in the history of comics, but they were also very horrific. Even by today's standards, people would be kind of shocked by some of the stories that they told.
And were these like Tales from the Crypt and stuff like that a lot?
That's exactly right.
Yes, which most people remember that HBO series and the Crypt Keeper and all that stuff.
That's right. Today we appreciate them probably a lot more than Frederick Wortham did back then.
The first story in the Lost Marvel's Number One, Tower of Shadows, is called At the Stroke of Midnight. And of course, it was edited by Stan Lee. This story, it starts the collection off very strongly. Is that one of your favorites out of this?
I would say it is. It's probably my favorite story. There's a lot of really good stories in there, and especially because of the artists. These are the top line of Marvel's artists, all the ones that made their superhero comics famous are also here in this Tower of Shadows. Steranko really stood out.
And you're talking about Jim Steranko.
That's
Jim
correct.
Steranko, he's the artist, yeah.
But he drew them in such a way that they used a lot of cinematic elements, but they also used narrative devices that you could only do in comics. Because in comics, time gets translated spatially. Mm-hmm. So he will slow things down. He'll break a panel up, a single image, into several panels.
Yeah, I'm looking at one right now. Because this is about a couple. These couples are never happy in these stories. It's kind of like The Twilight Zone.
Or that's
those
right.
Stories. So those
that's
sorts
very
of
similar,
series.
Yeah.
They're on their way to this house. They want the inheritance. That's the other thing. They always want the inheritance. And so they want some money. And so they end up in this old spooky house. And so I'm looking at one where you see like the steps and the shadow is in like the last frame and all this stuff, but it's all like broken up, but beautifully broken up.
Yes, that's exactly right. The panels will stretch or they'll shrink depending on how he wants us to feel the time. So it's very effective, and it uses devices that are particular to comics.
What I found was, while some of the stories feel dated, they have some problematic references that we wouldn't use these days. One of the stories about the fear of technology, it was basically like a miner who was like, look, I'm not going to let these robots take my job. We got to be careful. I mean, people are still feeling that way, right?
Yeah.
What stood out to you about these stories?
Well, they're somewhat in the vein of the old EC stories in that the characters are not heroic. Mm-mm. Sort of lousy characters that did terrible things and deserved all the awful things that happened to them. When I first started reading Tower Shadows, because I grew up with comics, I was at that point ready to move on from superheroes. Mm. You know, I like the superheroes, I like Spider-Man, etc., but I was looking for something a little more sophisticated. And so when I ran across Tower of Shadows, I was delighted because it was something different.
Did you run across it back in the day, or are you talking about running across it now?
Back in the day,
Back in the day, so you actually were reading these back in the day?
I still got those comics.
Oh, wow. You were looking for something more sophisticated. And is that why you had these comic book greats like Neil Adams, like Jim Steranko, like John Buscema, like they appear in this collection? Is that why they would want to get into this, is because it gave them some more freedom to explore their own art?
Yeah, that's a good point, because these are artists that have been drawing these superhero stories. So this is an opportunity for them to do their own writing. Sometimes they were artists who normally either only do the penciling or only do the inking. And here they were allowed to both pencil and ink their own work. And using different kind of genre conventions. They weren't limited to the kind of flashy, clattering kind of superhero battles that they were normally having to depict.
That's Michael Dean, editor of Lost Marvels number 1, Tower of Shadows, which is out now. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. You know that great-sounding instrument kids learn in elementary school? The recorder? If you somehow manage to escape attending one of these concerts, the recorder is a woodwind music instrument. It's got a thumb hole and 7 finger holes. And when it's played by a gaggle of children, it often sounds like, well, you tell me. According to a new report, though, from the Associated Board of Royal Schools of Music in the United Kingdom, the number of kids learning the recorder has dropped.
There's definitely been a shift in our curriculum.
That's Essel Linton, a music teacher in Annandale, Virginia. She says the use of the recorder has declined in American classrooms, too, out of necessity.
During COVID time, we were restricted in using the wind instruments.
Makes sense. Other instruments had to substitute. Linton, for example, turned to the ukulele. She says other teachers use digital technology on computers to teach young virtuosos.
My colleague and I brought recorder back with our third graders. We started it back like 2 years ago. And the students love it, but there's definitely other opportunities. So I could understand that there might be a notice of a decline.
That might be music to your ears, but Linton says when it comes to learning to play an instrument, there's really no comparison. The recorder reigns supreme.
You know, it's affordable. You can purchase a pretty decent plastic recorder instrument for less than $10. You know, it's portable. The kids pick up on it pretty quickly.
And it means kids can quickly master that old favorite, hot cross buns. One a penny, two a penny, hot cross buns.
It requires 3 pitches going from one note to the other next to each other. So I feel like that's just the first song that everybody knows.
Fun fact, it also shares a melody with 3 blind mice. As a music teacher, Linton also has to listen to a lot of this. So does she like it?
Yes, I love the recorder, especially when they play well. So, I mean, I would say the very first time we teach recorder to third graders, I kind of have to mentally prepare myself.
Most kids learn to play the recorder as a bridge to other wind instruments like clarinet or trumpet. But the recorder is no child's instrument. Many of the great composers wrote music for recorder, like Johann Sebastian Bach. Essel Linton played in a recorder ensemble when she was growing up in South Korea. She says it's a shame that most students don't continue with recorder after the 3rd and 4th grades. If they or anyone practice and learn to use their breath properly, they could grow up to play the recorder as well as Essel Linton. This is NPR News.
An election is underway in Washington, D.C. for the D.C. Bar Association.
I've been a member of the D.C. Bar for 30 years, and this is the first time that the election has generated this kind of interest.
This time, the brother of Attorney General Pam Bondi is one of the candidates. What would he want to do with an organization that many conservatives criticize? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Representatives of the U.S. and Iran have wrapped up a fourth round of talks in Oman to discuss Iran's nuclear program. Oman says plans are underway for another round. President Trump travels to the Middle East tomorrow. A ceasefire between India and Pakistan appears to be holding today. Both sides had accused the other of violations shortly after it went into effect yesterday. And a Tufts University student is back in Boston after spending more than 6 weeks in a Louisiana detention center. Rumaisa Ozturk was taken off the street by immigration agents and told her student visa had been revoked. A judge ordered her release Friday. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Canada's relationship with the U.S. has been tense, given President Trump's tariffs on Canadian imports and his calls to make the country America's 51st state. And that tension is being felt in many places, including the ballpark. Casey Martin from KUOW in Seattle reports.
Usually, when the Toronto Blue Jays come to Seattle, a lot of Mariners fans skip the games. The ballpark is almost completely taken over by Canadian baseball fans who have come from Vancouver, BC, just a few hours north across the border.
I come down here the last three summers and I'm like, it doesn't even feel like being on the road here, which I love because it's all Canadians here.
Adam Menikefs is originally from Toronto and now lives in Vancouver. He and his girlfriend rode the train from downtown Seattle to the ballpark.
This time we get on, not a single Jays fan was on the train. That was the start of where I was like, okay, things feel different.
He thought, surely, when he gets to the game, there'd be the typical sea of royal blue Toronto jerseys. But
it is the bleakest, most little amount of Jays fans that I've seen in the 3 years that we've been coming down.
Menikef's girlfriend, Lila, who was born in the U.S., says she was not surprised to see fewer Canadians than normal.
100%. I told him that before coming down. I was like, there's going to be way less Jays fans here. Like, people are boycotting.
Since the election of Donald Trump and his talk about taking over Canada, she says people don't want to spend their money here. That hurts Seattle hotels, restaurants, and tourist spots. Many places in town are offering specials and discounts for visiting Canadians to remind them that they and their dollars are welcome here. Red Canadian maple leaves with hearts were hung up near the popular Pike Place Market. And a lot of Toronto fans did show up, even if it felt less than before. Like Kelly Greer, who came from the nearby Vancouver Island.
I've been a Blue Jay fan pretty much my whole life, and it's been on my bucket list to make it down here. We're here for all three games.
Attendance was down by about 3,000 people compared to the last time Toronto visited. Greer said she did have President Donald Trump on her mind when she headed south.
it's almost enough to not come, but I'm such a big Blue Jays fan, and they only come here a couple times a year, and for me to go to Toronto would be pretty much impossible, so Seattle was it, and I just kind of put that behind and said, we're going to come and have a good time.
One Toronto fan waved a sign during the game that said, better a carny than a clown. He didn't want to share his name as he's trying to renew his green card.
My parents were supposed to visit this month, actually, but they canceled their trip. They're just not sure about like what might go on at the border, at the crossing.
U.S. Customs and Border Patrol says the number of Canadians coming into America has dropped about a quarter since the start of the year. Troy Lamar says he definitely sees the difference. He drives a pedicab around the ballpark and counts on a Blue Jays series to mean good business. Friday night was slow, he said.
There's usually Blue Jays fans everywhere. You feel the vibe. But today, the vibe was, like, minimal.
Adam Menikevs says he understands why many Canadians are boycotting and hopes in the future baseball fans can feel comfortable visiting the U.S.
We're all kind of suffering. We're all feeling it. Everything's worse. Like, this game is going to be not as fun. The game is going to be less exciting.
It was exciting for the Toronto fans who did show up. The Blue Jays beat the Mariners in that first game.
We stand on guard for thee.
For NPR News, I'm Casey Martin in Seattle.
In southern Costa Rica, local lore has told of two sunken pirate ships just off the coast in the shallow Caribbean waters. Well, there are sunken ships there, and they do date to the early 1700s. But a new excavation shows they didn't belong to pirates. They were Danish ships carrying hundreds of enslaved people from Ghana. Andreas Block joins us now. He's a marine archaeologist at the National Museum of Denmark, and he worked on the excavation. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Aisha.
So let's start with the history of these two Danish vessels. They had a dramatic journey, right, including a rebellion on board?
Oh, yeah, it was super dramatic. They already, when even leaving Denmark, they lost the medical doctor. And then there was a rebellion on board.
So it was a rebellion by the enslaved people? They rebelled?
Yes. For some reason, they were able to almost take the command of the ship. And, yeah, there was a very brutal punishment of the people that tried to break free. But they completely missed the target. They were meant to go to St. Thomas. But they had a not very good captain who was not very good at navigating, so they missed the point where they had to turn up to St. Thomas, and they ended up in the Caribbean Sea by 2,000 kilometers, actually missing the goal, ending up having a mutiny at the coast of Costa Rica at the National Park of Cahuita.
Oh, wow. And so what happened to the Africans who were enslaved on the ships?
Well, that's a super interesting story. And it's sort of like it takes three different routes. So a bit more than 20 goes with the mutinists and the Danish crew to Portobello in Panama. A bit more than 100 are recaptured by the Spanish in the city of Matina and sold again by the Spanish to the people living there. And then there's a bit more than 500 that are unaccounted for. So they could have gone into the mountains. They could have joined with the Miskito Indians, with the Bribri Indians, with the British. So we really don't know where the remaining 500 went.
Do we know if there are any descendants from the ships still living in Costa Rica?
So there are people there who has a direct line. Also with the Danish sailors, there's also a direct line that we can trace. It actually sort of moves the date of when you have Africans coming to that particular coast and being sold as slaves, which is sort of pushing that arrival back by 150 years. So that's quite an amazing add-on to history.
What was the evidence that you found that helped confirm that these were Danish ships?
So we needed 20 samples of the bricks, the yellow bricks that were transported on the ships. This particular type of brick was Danish by size and color. And then we also found clay pipes, and the clay pipes, they date exactly up to the point in 1708 when the ships, they leave. And then sort of the absolutely best tool for identification was the wood and the ship frame. The area where this wood was actually cut down, which is in the western part of the Baltic Sea, which fits absolutely perfect with the wood being used in a Danish ship in this period. So everything fits.
So what do you think is the impact of this revelation for Danish history and for Costa Rican history?
I think the impact in Danish history is that people now are very aware of these two ships. And I hope the impact will be that more people get to learn more about this period, this horrible period in Danish history. And then I think it's super important for the Costa Ricans to realize that the Afro-Caribbean people in Costa Rica arrived much earlier than history says. And they're part of the culture, and they're part of the country and always have been. And that is why we're such a beautiful world, because everything is mixed and interesting.
That's Andreas Block with the National Museum of Denmark. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to learn to beatbox, Kevin Alushala has a few tips.
I always say it's the boots and the cats. That's the kick and the snare. And if you can do that, you can just start messing around with vocal sounds.
Okay, so I don't think I can do that, but I get what you're saying. can you beatbox a little bit for us?
Absolutely.
Alushala's musical gifts distinguished him as a member of the hit a cappella group Pentatonix, and now he's gone solo. Alushala's released his first album, Dawn of a Misfit. It's a kaleidoscope of sounds and feelings that reflect his struggle to appreciate the different parts of himself.
Growing up, I just felt like I never fit in anywhere. I'm a part African, part Grenadian, cello playing, Chinese speaking Kentucky boy.
Okay, that's a lot. That's a lot.
Exactly, it's a lot. And I was bullied and teased for a lot of that. I didn't feel like I was black enough for the black kids. I felt like I was too black for the white kids. Nobody said, oh, we fully accept you just the way you are, or I didn't feel like I got that same type of acceptance from them. So many years, even up until in my adult life, I asked God, why am I here if I don't fit in anywhere? But I realized that misfits aren't broken. Misfits are meant to be original. And the things that you were misunderstood for, that actually may be the superpower you need to change your world.
You used to be my sweetest song. Turns out the auto-tune was on. You used to be my northern lights. Turns out it was just CGI once.
Well, I mean, this album, it has these mashups and these different things all put together. There's hip-hop, you know, mixed in with lots of classical, Beethoven, Vivaldi. How does something like that come to you?
You know what? I grew up absolutely loving classical music, and that lexicon is so embedded in me. But I listened to a lot of popular music growing up, and they felt like two disparate parts of me. But as I was going through this personal journey, I realized they are both me.
This freedom looked too good on me.
Something like this, it took time for me to just take the Messiah Hallelujah chorus and chop it up in a way that felt like I could put it into pop chord progression. And then I added the beat, and I knew I wanted this to be a song that kind of juxtaposed this worship type feel with a breakup idea, which shouldn't really go together, but that's the juxtaposition that is me, right? Adding these things that shouldn't really make sense. It turned out to be something that was beautiful in its own right.
You already know. So funny how since you've been gone, I'm singing hallelujah.
Did you incorporate some of your influences from, because your parents immigrated from Nigeria and Grenada, are any of those cultural influences present on the album?
Absolutely. It may not necessarily be present as much in the sonics, but the story of so many first-gen kids in America trying to understand how do they reconcile the culture of their parents, but also being American, and everybody is telling them that this is the dominant culture that they have to assimilate to, is infused in the album completely.
You also have a cello rendition of Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come. This song dates back to the Jim Crow era, and it came out shortly before Sam Cooke's untimely death. And it was partly inspired by an experience Sam Cooke and his entourage had when they were turned away from a whites-only motel in Louisiana. It has now taken on so much as a song that is about the African-American experience. Why did you include it on your album?
When I think about how timeless this song is, I think its message is so relevant today, but it doesn't just include the African-American experience. I think it also includes the experience of so many Afro-Caribbean, first-gen, immigrant, third culture, because there are a lot of people that still look at everybody that look like us the same. And my hope is that there is a change that comes where people now are not stereotyping everybody into one box, but are realizing the Black diaspora is extremely diverse. There's an expansion that you have to take into consideration so that you see the beauty of the culture. I call it Technicolor Black. And once we start to do that, we're gonna see, a change to come, that you cannot, as Martin Luther King said, judge somebody by just the way they look. You have to understand the context of their character, their background, their personage, to really understand the love that's inside of them.
Say good luck, Daddy.
Good luck, Daddy.
Say you're gonna do great.
You're gonna do great.
Say God will bless your cello.
God will bless your cello.
I want to end with the kind of the cutest part of your album, your children who make a cameo toward the end. What did it mean to you to have them on the album, and how do your kids inspire you?
Everything I do now is for my children. Them growing up in this day and age, they are going to be misfits. Their dad being Afro-Caribbean, their mom being, you know, Caucasian. I want them to feel like they can celebrate all the parts of who they are. This album, this is my history book, so that they can understand their father better and that they can listen back and see what their dad was thinking about at the time and feel absolutely loved and cherished by their father.
The music artist Kevin Alushala. He has a new album out. It's called Dawn of a Misfit. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Thank you.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Listen to me, dear school girls. At me, do not shake your flesh. For what I'm going to say to you, you will find I'm also true. If only you're ambitious, yes, ever so fastidious, please digest them word for word. They will help you to go forward. Learn to be the best of school girls.